Hey, joined right now by John Peterson, an activist based up in Minneapolis, and he's involved with a project called Hands Off Venezuela. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. Great to be here.
Tell my listeners about the Hands Off Venezuela project. What inspired you guys to get involved?
In April of 2002, as many of your listeners must be aware, there was a coup against the democratically elected government of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
That coup was reversed by basically an uprising of the masses of the ordinary Venezuelan people, who said that, you know, we elected this guy, we'll decide when he gets taken out of power. It was revealed that the United States Embassy, the State Department, the CIA, and so on, had been involved in this overthrow, and we therefore launched an international campaign at the end of that year, at the end of 2002, basically stating that we want the U.S. government to keep its hands off Venezuela, to let the people of Venezuela decide for themselves what kind of government they want, what kind of economy they want, and basically how they want to run their lives. That was the sort of the inspiration for this campaign. Over the last few years, then, we've been developing it around the world. We're active in about 40 different countries, and our main aims are basically to build solidarity with the Venezuelan revolution, to counter the lies of the mainstream media as to what's really going on in Venezuela, and to help build ties between people in Venezuela and people in the United States, particularly between trade unionists. We've brought up, you know, workers from Venezuela to go on tour to talk about their experiences here in the U.S., and we've also sent down delegations to visit different, you know, occupied factories and, you know, to check out the elections as they take place on Venezuela. So that's a little bit about the campaign and what we're up to.
Wow. Yeah, I think there's a lot of really remarkable things happening down in Central and South America. The dramatic changes going on in Bolivia with Evo Morales and obviously, a lot of what's happened in Venezuela has been the impetus and in many cases the funding for a lot of, just to help support a lot of these other countries that are again leaning left and kicking out the American imperialist companies and trying to have governments that actually serve the people of those countries. And Chavez has been at the forefront of it. Basically, you know, when oil prices were high, he had a lot of money coming his way and was able to help build this coalition. And it's been remarkable. And it's frustrating that more Americans don't understand who he is, and they believe the stuff we hear in the mainstream. I even heard Joe Biden refer to Hugo Chavez once as a dictator.
Sure. I mean, what a lot of people don't understand is that Chavez has been elected, I think, either directly elected or initiatives that he's proposed have been approved, I think, about 11 different times over the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very high level of democratic participation by the people of Venezuela in deciding what kind of government, what kind of policies they want. I think it's true, as you say, also, that it's not just about Venezuela. It's also what's going on in Bolivia, in Ecuador. Even if we look just south of the border to a lot of the big mobilizations that have been taking place in Mexico, for example, against electoral fraud in 2006, against the privatization of the state oil company, for example. So what we have here is really, truly a Latin America-wide revolutionary wave, a movement where people, after decades of being, you know, pretty much the U.S.'s backyard, as a lot of people considered it, where their natural resources were exploited, where their labor was exploited in order to enrich especially the big multinational corporations, most of them based in the U.S., as well as the sort of the oligarchy, as they're known, as the sort of the rich people in those countries. People are taking things into their own hands, and I think ultimately what policymakers in the U.S. are worried about is that example of ordinary people, people who used to be illiterate, who now know how to read, people who used to think that they had no real say in politics, that example of these people taking things into their own hands, beginning to rebuild their communities, beginning to take back their trade unions, beginning even to occupy factories and to start to run them under workers' control in order to produce products that the community and the society as a whole needs. That example is very dangerous, especially in these hard economic times when we have factory closures here in this country, when we have, you know, millions, literally millions of layoffs in the last couple of years, when trade unions are under attack. When we have inflation in food and energy and so on, you know, United States workers aren't used to that kind of a situation, and they're, I think, in a bit of a shock. at what's going on, what we're suffering here. And that example, therefore, is very dangerous if it were to catch on here.
Right. Well, it's interesting that, you know, a similar dynamic during the 80s and the successes that Daniel Ortega had in Nicaragua was obviously seen as a huge threat by Reagan, because in Nicaragua they were better educated, better health care, better employment. The people were it was a much happier, much more bustling economy than their neighbors were. And Ortega was a communist and a socialist, very much admitted that. And that's why there was such an overreaction that somehow, somehow Ortega in Nicaragua was some threat to the United States. That's just impossible. The threat was, by example, this was a successful company, a country that had turned socialist and would provide an example to all their neighbors.
Well, I think one thing that we've seen throughout history is that revolutions don't respect borders, just like mm-hmm. a wildfire doesn't recognize borders. The same thing goes with ideas. You can't stop ideas with border walls, you can't stop ideas with border patrols and so on. And I think that's the real danger, as you said. Now, in Venezuela, there's a lot of great stuff that's been taking place, but there's still a lot of big contradictions, problems still that have to be resolved. We're talking about a relatively poor country, despite its massive oil reserves and its massive natural resources, for decades had been sort of ground down by these multinational companies and by the local millionaires. So it's not going to be a day and night transformation. A lot of people point to the remaining poverty in Venezuela as an example that it really isn't working. But the fact is, poverty used to be near 80%. Now it's down to about 25%. That's still quite high. There's still a long ways to go. And I think that there's some fundamental things that need to happen in this revolutionary process in order to address those issues. But at least on the surface, it has to be admitted that there's been a lot of progress made as far as eliminating illiteracy, increasing access to health care for everybody, increasing access to basic foodstuffs to everybody. I think people here in the U.S. Wouldn't mind having some of those things themselves, such as universal health care, at least basic access to health care.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people forget that Chavez has actually helped out back where I'm from, back in New England, where I grew up. Chavez has actually sold oil, heating oil, below cost to poor people in the northeast of the United States. Here's somebody who's kind of gone out of his way to help actual real people, struggling working people. Yet for some reason, he can't, the media and, well, I guess it's the government driving it, is constantly trying to paint him as some sort of villain or madman or crazy dictator, when it's really not the case.
No, I think you're right. It's that danger of the example, the danger of a country actually taking its own natural and human resources into its own hands and democratically deciding how they want to use them. I'm based here in Minneapolis, where one of our big companies is Cargill, the Cargill Corporation, big food, agricultural corporation. And down in Venezuela, in order to make sure that everybody has access to basic food, they've instituted a series of price controls. Now, in order to get around those price controls, a lot of big corporations have been sort of, fudging with the product. The price controls are on plain white rice, for example. So these companies, what they do is they add artificial food coloring, or they might add, I don't know, chicken flavor or something like that to the rice, and then they can sell it at a far higher price than the regulated prices that should be available to all people who have a very low wage on average, especially with all the inflation going on. So what ended up happening in Venezuela was the workers at several rice processing plants, they ended up occupying the factories. You know, those workers at those factories, they can see what's going on. They know best how that factory runs, what comes in, what goes out, where the profits are going, who's getting paid what. They decided to occupy some of these factories in protest against this sort of skirting of the regulations. And what ended up happening was that the rice plants owned by Cargill, based here in Minneapolis, ended up being expropriated, nationalized by the Chavez government to be put to use in the interests of society as a whole. So I think that's an interesting development. And again, that's why they want to demonize Chavez. And that's also why I think they focus a lot on the individual of Chavez himself. It's easier to demonize one person than to demonize a whole country, because the fact is it's actually millions and millions of ordinary Venezuelans who are, pushing forward this revolutionary process. When Chavez was overthrown in April 2002, he was brought back to power, not on his own will, but by literally millions of people that came down on the streets, overthrew the new coup government, mm-hmm. which had been recognized by the United States government, and they brought their guy Hugo Chavez back. So it's not just about this one individual, it's about literally millions and millions of people, you know, workers, urban poor, housewives, peasants, that really see in this guy, and above all in this revolutionary process, a hope for a better future for themselves and for their children.
Well, it's interesting. I guess it's not a surprise that the U.S. government recognized the government that committed the coup against Chavez. There are those that believe it was actually the CIA that was behind the coup in the first place. So I'm sure they were quite ready to accept that government as legitimate.
Well, what's quite funny about it too is that the United States often tries to portray itself as a great defender of democracy and mm-hmm. so on. And yet the first things that the coup makers, what they did, is they abolished the Constitution, they disbanded the National Assembly, they disbanded the Supreme Court, they changed the name of the country back from the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, just back to the Republic of Venezuela. They set the cops out on the streets, a couple dozen, mm-hmm. As many as 50 people were shot and killed. They were beating up, pro-Chavez people. I mean, that wasn't very democratic at all, to say the least, and yet the U.S. government immediately recognized it as a legitimate government and something that they would support. Mm-hmm. Of course, the Venezuelan masses, as I already explained, had a different opinion on all of this, and they were able to bring Chavez back and therefore sort of push the revolution forward even further. Mm-hmm. But it is pretty laughable that they consider this government some sort of a dictatorship when what they supported, which is completely undemocratic, certainly was a dictatorship.
Well, it seems to be a pattern of that. We're in favor of democracy as long as the vote goes our way and there's someone loyal to us put in place. I'm sure it goes back further than this. Another example in South America was Allende in Chile in the 70s and Henry Kissinger.
I mean, when Salvador Allende was overthrown in 1970, in the early 70s in Chile, the pattern that they used to overthrow him is extremely similar to what they tried to do against Chavez. A lot of media confusion, trying to get the military on board, different sectors of the oligarchy sort of staging lockouts of the economy, sabotage and so on, mobilizations on the streets to try and destabilize things, confuse the situation. Because if you remember, we were told in 2002 when Chavez was overthrown that what happened was that he had shot his own people. He had, he had ordered the shooting of people and that there was an uprising to overthrow him. When in fact what happened was it was the opposition that had shot a bunch of Chavez supporters, and with the help of the military, they had, overthrown him. So it was very different what we heard in the media than what actually happened.
Wow. Unbelievable. Now, recently, Chavez was on another referendum to go beyond his normal turn limits and actually won that by a huge margin. Again, a dictator would not have put this to an election. He would have just assumed the power. But actually, he went out there and put up on a referendum to extend his term and won. I wonder if you could speak to that at all.
Sure. There was a recent referendum on the Venezuelan constitution, which basically abolished term limits for all elected officials, including governors, including mayors, and of course the presidency. So it wasn't a referendum on whether or not Chavez should remain in power or not. As such, obviously, if he wins the next presidential elections, then he can stay in power. But it wasn't that. It was just eliminating term limits. And if we remember, here in the United States, there were no term limits on the presidency for decades. It was only after FDR that they implemented them.
The Republicans
rallied.
There's no
term limits, as far as I know, at least in most cases, when it comes to senators and mayors and other elected officials. So, and in fact, it's actually more democratic, I think, in a lot of ways, especially in the context of Venezuela. The people of Venezuela want to have more choices. They want to be able to vote for whoever they want to, and not to have people automatically have to go. You know, there's a lot of leaders in that government that they think are very good. They want them to stay. There's also several leaders in the Venezuelan government that the Venezuelan people don't like and they would like to get rid of. But that decision is going to be taken by the voters. Nonetheless, I think that what's fundamental for the Venezuelan revolution isn't, you know, all these elections that they keep having. It's really great that they've got these referendums. It shows how democratic the process is, and it shows how much support the, you know, the revolution still has, Chavez's policies still have, even after 10 years, even though many of the fundamental problems haven't been solved. But I think what really has to happen for the revolution to deepen, and this is the sort of the conversation that's taking place in the country now, these are the sort of mobilizations that are taking place in the country now after this referendum, is the question of who really controls the state, who really controls the economy. In my opinion, and in the opinion of many increasing numbers of people, hundreds of thousands, I'd say, of people in Venezuela, workers in the factories, the peasants and so on. The factories need to be nationalized under workers' control by the state. They need to be taken over by the government. The big factories that aren't being used, that are being underutilized, some of the food-producing factories are only running at 30% capacity because they can't make profits due to the regulated prices. Well, what should those factories be there for? They should be there in order to produce for the interest of the people. Mm-hmm. That's why we think those factories should be nationalized and put under workers' democratic control to be run in the interest of society, that the land should also be nationalized and put under the democratic control of the peasantry and of society as a whole in order to make sure that there's enough food for everybody. And then, of course, the banking system should also be nationalized and put under democratic control to be run in the interests of the whole of society. Because what you have is you still have those key levers of power, the banks, the land, and the factories, the key industries that are still largely in private hands, and they're using them in order to leverage their own power, their own interests, in order to try and destabilize the regime. There's often food shortages. There's often peasants that are being murdered when they try and, you know, take over land that isn't being used in order to start producing. The banking system is still highly skewed towards the most wealthy in society as far as who gets credits and who doesn't. So in my opinion, those things should be taken under the control of society and run democratically by the workers themselves.
Do you have any concern about, well, a combination of things? Let me kind of throw these out there. Well, the media reports about the big drug wars going on in Mexico, Plan Colombia, us militarizing Colombia. Do you think the war on drugs is being set up as a way in, as a way to put more of our military into Central and South America?
Well, I actually just got back from Mexico about 3 days ago, and the drug war question, the question of narco-trafficking, is obviously really high on people's minds. There's entire regions of Mexico that are falling out of centralized state control, where you have narco-traffickers who have, you know, better weapons than the military, better weapons than the police, and are basically running the show. Now, I think that what that reflects ultimately is the decay and the decline of the capitalist system in Mexico itself and throughout Latin America. You have similar situations in Brazil. Mm-hmm. You have similar situations in countries like El Salvador and Guatemala. And so I think that the drug war, things like Plan Colombia in Colombia, of course, and this new plan called Plan Merida, which is a Mexico version of Plan Colombia, that these are clearly efforts by the U.S. in order to impose their power in the region. They definitely use, they've used, in the case of Colombia, the excuse of the drug war to get their troops in, to get their paramilitaries in, to get their, you know, so-called advisors in order to train, you know, Colombian military, imperial military forces, in order to ultimately stop the Venezuelan revolution at the Colombian border and in order to make sure that Colombia remains a stronghold for pro-U.S. You know, individuals such as the current president, Uribe. Mm-hmm. But I definitely think that the drug war, although it is obviously a very real thing in places like Mexico, it is at the same time being used as an excuse to militarize society. I think there's some 40,000 Mexican troops on the streets. It's a way of having the soldiers on the streets, not only to fight against the narco-traffickers, but ultimately when you have big, you know, trade union struggles, when you have big student struggles, when you have big mass mobilizations against fraud and things like that, or we had the uprising in the state of Oaxaca, especially in the city of Oaxaca, in southern Mexico about 2.5 years ago, that they're sort of desensitizing people to the presence of having the military on the streets, that they can use them against strikes, they can use them against student protests, they can use them against uprisings like we saw in Oaxaca. So I think that definitely is an excuse. Obama's latest plan, his budget that was approved, I believe, yesterday, includes millions of dollars to go towards a Plan Colombia-style plan for Mexico, which is called Plan Mérida.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's, I mean, just part of the bigger plan to expand that? To, I mean, we've also reintroduced, is it called Southcom, but U.S. The U.S. fleet circling the oceans around South America.
Sure, yeah, the U.S. Fourth Fleet, which was disbanded after the Cold War, was disbanded, I think, in 1951, because they didn't need it anymore, has now, for the first time last year, was relaunched in order to patrol Latin America and the Caribbean. Now, if that isn't a direct threat, a direct warning to those governments, to those people, saying, look, the United States, we might have our hands tied down in Iraq and in Afghanistan and so on, but we still have enough resources and we still have the desire to impose our power, to project our power in the region in order to put together a full aircraft carrier fleet to patrol your shores. You know, let's remember, Venezuela is a Caribbean country. Just 15 miles away is Aruba. You know, it's this Caribbean sort of paradise island. You know, just off the coast of Venezuela, one of the biggest oil-producing countries in the world, you have massive U.S. That's clearly a message to the countries, the rulers of the region. But I think at the same time, it has to be said that even 50 years ago, by now, the United States, we would have read the headlines, you know, the Marines have landed. The United States has intervened in Latin America literally hundreds of times over the last couple of hundred years in order to make sure that there's governments in place that defend the interests of the U.S. government and the interests of the U.S. multinational corporations, like the United Fruit Company, Chiquita Banana, and so on. You know, the Banana Republic era, gumbo diplomacy and all that stuff. We would have seen that sort of direct intervention in the past already. But I think the balance of forces is such that it'd be actually very difficult for the United States, for example, to invade Venezuela, given the correlation of forces today. I think the American people wouldn't be too keen on that, given the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. It's clear that the Venezuelan people would have nothing to do with that. The vast majority of the Venezuelan people would fight back. They wouldn't resist that. There would be all kinds of, you know, turmoil throughout Latin America. I would say even within the United States, with a huge Latino population, both immigrant population and population of people of Latinos that are born here, or live here, or citizens here that have continued ties with their countries in Latin America. So I think, you know, they obviously want to project that power, but how well can they actually use it in practice? I think that's still up for debate, and I think the best way to prevent them from being able to use that kind of power is to continue building these movements, and above all, in order to continue and to deepen and to consolidate and finish the revolution in Venezuela. Because I think the situation now, where you still have, like I said, the key parts of the economy in private hands, a factory worker isn't going to defend the boss's factory. A peasant isn't going to defend the landowner's land. Mm-hmm. But if that land gets transferred to the state, it's then being run collectively by the peasants. If those factories are transferred to the state, they're being run democratically, directly by the workers and by the communities. And if the banks are in state hands and so on, then you can be darn sure that the people are going to defend their interests against any sort of foreign aggression. So I think that's still that question can only be decisively answered by taking those decisive steps within Venezuela, and of course extending it not just in Venezuela, because you can't build socialism in one country. It has to be a worldwide system ultimately. So ultimately it's going to have to spread to the rest of Latin America, to the rest of Colombia, up through the Panama Canal and Central America into Mexico, and ultimately right here in the United States.
Do you have any hope that there'll be better relations between our country and Venezuela in an Obama administration?
Well, like you said, Joe Biden has already come out fairly aggressively against Chavez. Obama himself has also made not too veiled implications that Chavez isn't democratic and that it's Venezuela as some kind of a threat. I think that the Obama administration on the whole is going to be much more clever, much more subtle. I think it's going to try and use the carrot a lot more before it uses the stick. But at the same time, I think that fundamentally the interests that it defends are the interests of U.S. imperialism, as you said toward, at the beginning of the show. U.S. imperialism trying to gain profits in spheres of influence and natural resources and so on around the world, especially in the traditional quote-unquote backyard of Latin America. Mm-hmm. And so I think that although he won't be as brash, I think people like Hillary Clinton are going to be a lot more subtle in how they, come out and attack. Chavez and other rulers and the revolutions in general throughout the region. But I think that the fundamental policies will remain the same. For example, if he doesn't want to threaten Latin America, why not disband that fleet that we just talked about? Mm-hmm. If exactly. They don't want to threaten Latin America, why don't they stop funding the right-wing, narco-trafficking, paramilitary, murderous government of Uribe in Colombia? Why don't they stop backing all these right-wing governments, just as they backed, right-wing military dictatorships through the 70s and 80s and so on? Fundamentally, those policies aren't really changing. So I don't really expect better relations as long as the revolution continues to deepen and spread throughout Latin America. I just don't think that those relations can improve because they are a threat to the vital interests. They're certainly not going to invade. Venezuela isn't going to invade the United States. Nobody's going to invade the United States. There's no direct threat in that sense. But the interests of, the big U.S. corporations are under threat. And, again, that example of ordinary people taking things into their own hands is also a big threat.
Wow. John Peterson, Hands Off Venezuela, thanks so much for being with us today. Folks, you can learn more about this at handsoffvenezuela.org. They've got a website set up. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks for being so generous with your time. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Take care, everyone.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back. I've got time to entertain a couple of your phone calls if you are so inclined.